afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this press conference at the end of the climate meeting here in the Emeres Centre, just outside Swords in County Dublin. It's been my privilege as Archbishop of Armagh to host this meeting of the Primus of the Anglican Communion over the past week. And not only was it a privilege, it was also a pleasure. Four of my colleagues are here to address you and to give you the opportunity to ask them what you want to ask them. The Archbishop of Burundi, the Primus of the Scottish Episcopal Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who needs no introduction, and the Archbishop of the West Indies. So I'll leave it then to you, Your Grace.
Thank you very much, Archbishop. I'll just say a few words of introduction before inviting questions. And I want to begin by speaking about the tasks that were defined for this meeting and the tasks that have been completed. In the letter that I originally wrote last October, inviting primates to this meeting, I said, it is crucial that we have some decisions about the shape of an effective future standing committee or steering group for the primates. And also, I want to honour the significant work undertaken at the CAPA, that's the Council of Anglican Provinces in Africa, bishops' meeting in August. CAPA flagged up concerns around gender-based violence as a major issue for the churches to be clear about throughout the world, and one where the unanimous support of the primates will be essential. Later, in a follow-up letter just before Christmas, I noted that we should be thinking about what we mean by primacy itself, since we cannot get the clarity we so badly need about the nature and authority of this meeting unless we clarify for ourselves how we see this question. So one of my chief hopes for the meeting is to emerge with greater clarity and agreement about what we expect of the primates corporately and how best we can realise our expectations. In the light of that, I'm very glad to say that we have now a document about how we understand the work and calling and responsibility of the primates meeting, the result of a number of days of very intensive discussion of our theologies of the church and of ministry. And we have also redefined the task of the standing committee of the primates meeting, reaffirming its independence of the standing committee of the Anglican Consultative Council and giving to it some limited rights of inviting people in for particular purposes and particular pieces of work. So I think we have fulfilled the task as expressed in those letters of clarifying what we think about the meeting and helping to set up some structures that will serve it a bit more effectively. We've also, as a result of a very moving, not to say harrowing, presentation on gender-related violence, drawn up a very substantial statement of what we believe to be the responsibilities of the churches in combating violence based on gender throughout the world. I'll come back to that in a moment. So I begin simply by saying those were the tasks set. Those are the tasks we've completed. There have been, of course, a significant number of absentees from this meeting for a number of reasons. The fact remains that two-thirds of the body of primates was present, and something like three-quarters, possibly a little more, expressed their willingness to be present, but were unable for one reason or another. That means that two-thirds of the primates of the communion, at least, wish to meet and wish to continue the conversations they've begun. As we've spelled things out in the documents we've agreed, we have laid emphasis on building relationships with those who chose not to be here, as well as those who are unable to be here, building relationships across the whole body of primates. That process continues. The meeting agreed a number of texts, and I'll just run through those very briefly. There's first, as I've said, an agreed statement about the nature and responsibility of the primates meeting itself. The way in which we worked on this occasion allowed the primates present a great deal of time and opportunity to define for themselves what they saw as the main priorities. And those are reflected in what has emerged in our document. All of that is, of course, rather focused on the housekeeping of the Anglican Communion. So let me mention the other statements and documents that we have agreed, because we have, as always, been keenly aware of the larger issues we face in the world. There are three statements agreed by the meeting. One addresses the continuing crisis in Haiti, assures the people of Haiti, and especially the church there, of our prayers and our concern, and expresses appreciation of the work that the church continues to do in what is still a devastated situation. There's a second statement on climate change, recognizing that this is not an academic or abstract question for some in the communion, especially those living in the Pacific region, where rising water levels are now putting at risk the lives and livelihood of many people in the region, and those coming from the region made a very strong bid that we should be explicit about that. A third statement echoes the statement which I myself published on Friday, deploring the murder of the Ugandan activist David Kato, and reaffirming what a number of our meetings and official documents have said over many years, that the Anglican Communion is wholly opposed to violence directed against people who identify as gay or lesbian. And now to the letters. Rather than issue a long communique trying to pick up a number of not very well related issues, it seemed to us more profitable to address specific issues through small working groups, drawing up letters to a number of people in critical situations. So, there is, first of all, an open letter on gender-based violence to the Communion. The content of that, I've already hinted at, it picks up a number of statements, again, that have been made by Anglican bodies, underlines the seriousness of this, particularly in the Great Lakes region of Africa. The presentation on this was made by Archbishop Bernard of Burundi, based partly on work done by the Archbishop of Congo. A second open letter is addressed to the President of Zimbabwe. As you may know, the Anglican Church in Zimbabwe currently faces serious harassment and violence from security forces and activists connected with the former Bishop of Harare, Norbert Kunonga. We have expressed our sympathy and solidarity with the very courageous, faithful and leadership of the Anglican Church in Zimbabwe, and urged for a resolution of the problems that they face in accordance with legal decisions already given. Other letters we don't propose to treat as open letters, but I can tell you something about their direction and content. A letter has gone to the primate of the Episcopal Church of Sudan, assuring him of prayers at this time of instability and transition in Sudan, congratulating him and his colleagues on the peaceful process of the referendum, and affirming the pastoral priorities he himself has identified in a letter to Lambeth Palace very recently. A further letter has gone to the President and members of the government in Pakistan, picking up the persecution of Christians there, the great concern that we feel as a result of rising levels of violence against Christian minorities there, deploring the assassination of the governor who was killed around Christmas, and the continuing pressure on Christian communities in that country. A letter has gone to the Prime Minister of Israel, picking up the current situation of the Anglican bishop in Jerusalem, whose residency permit has been suspended. This has more or less paralyzed a lot of the work of the diocese. Recently, we've asked for that again to be resolved as speedily as possible. We have written to the representatives of the six nations involved in negotiations in Korea, once again prompted by strong representations from the church there. Again, urging a peaceful resolution, the peaceful reunification of the country, and for everything to be done to lower current tensions. Finally, we have written to the President Bishop of the province of Jerusalem in the Middle East, who is also the bishop in Egypt, Bishop Munir Anis, and to the head of the Coptic Church in Egypt, assuring them of our prayers and concern, not only about the tragic events that have overtaken Christian communities in Egypt in recent weeks, but also our concern about the current levels of instability and violence in Cairo and other cities, and promising them our prayers. Those are the tasks we set ourselves, those are the tasks we've completed, those are the documents we have agreed, and we'll be very happy to take your questions.
I guess the kind of elephant in the room this whole conference is those prelates that chose not to come because of their disappointment with the lack of discipline against the Episcopal Church. How has this prelate meeting been able to function without them? What is the relationship with them going forward? And is there sort of a crisis in the communion?
I'll say a brief word and then perhaps invite one or two others to join in. As I've said, the absence was felt and noted every day. The names of the absent primates were in front of us every day, literally. That is, at first on empty chairs, and then in front of a candle in the middle of the room. So we were not oblivious of the difficulty. As I've said, however, the fact is that invitations went to everyone. Attempts were made to craft a style of meeting which would not offend the consciences of people coming. But some people still felt that it was not possible to be here. So what we were left with was the business we could still do together because we wanted to be together and to settle something about the nature of the meeting, and as well as the other more urgent immediate problems. Of course there is a critical situation in the communion. Nobody would deny that. But that critical situation has not ended the relationships, often very cordial and very constructive, between churches within the communion. And I've myself had meetings recently with some of those who are not going to be present, and others are planned. So there's no suggestion that this is somehow closing the door on those who are not with us. I don't know if colleagues would like to say anything.
I think, as you rightly asked, some of the members of the primates meeting did not attend, and a good number of them are from Africa. And the issues that they raised are, for me, as far as we are concerned, are very understandable. But what we have to understand is that the Anglican Communion is like a family. And when in a family there are issues that come up, people do not agree or do not see in the same way the well-being of the family, some actions are taken and some decisions are taken. First of all, I would like to say that they have not withdrawn from the life of the Anglican Communion. They are still members of the Anglican Communion. And when we met in August, and also in October, as primates of Kappa, we made a decision that attending or not attending would be decided by each province individually. That's why you see Burundi and other provinces from Africa have attended. As a decision taken by the House of Bishops in Burundi, if I talk about Burundi, but also other provinces who are here. Not attending physically does not mean that you are not participating in the life of the communion. I personally believe that whether they are here or they are not in Dublin, their hearts and aspirations is to see that the Anglican Communion develops positively and works together for the furtherance of the kingdom of God. The issues are still there. And I think it was very good for us who attended that those issues were addressed in the sense that we believe and recognize that there are difficulties within the communion. But it is those difficulties and those issues and questions that we are being to face together and see how we solve them and see how we continue living together. So participation is a commitment to the future and to the life of the communion, wherever one is, as a member of this large and worldwide family.
And let me piggyback a little further on Mr. Devin's question here and focus a little more directly. How do you propose, Archbishop, to re-establish your credibility with the absentee primates and bring them back to the primatial table, bearing in mind that Gascon and the Jerusalem Declaration are now a reality, and they represent in reality about 70% of the practicing Anglican communion, though with fewer archbishops? They actually have the bulk of the primates behind them. How do you propose to do that?
I might have a few words to say about the phraseology of establishing credibility, which I think begs a few questions. The answer is, as I've already indicated, we hope that the new members of the Primate Standing Committee will all of them be doing some work to re-establish local and regional relationships. And as I said, I myself am in very regular contact with all of them. I shall be meeting one of the African primates and some colleagues in a couple of weeks' time. I've recently met with the Archbishop of Kenya for a very long and detailed conversation about a number of matters. I shall be visiting Africa twice in the course of this year and continuing relationships with the province of Southeast Asia directly, face-to-face, person-to-person, continue. It's a long task.
Perhaps I might say a word. It's my first primates meeting. It seems to me that the accusation against the past has been either that primates have failed to agree or that having made decisions, they failed to carry them out. And I think what we have been doing has been a necessary preparation for the rebuilding of relationships, because what we have been doing has been to try and shape a picture of the life of the primates meeting, which is congruent, which is in line with the life of a communion, which is a communion of independent provinces, and where primates like me go home, and whatever is decided here or elsewhere within the communion has to be fed into provincial processes. It isn't automatically to be received simply because it comes from the communion. And the picture of the life of the primates meeting, which we have been developing here, is one which therefore is in line with the reality of the relational life of the communion, and therefore will not be subject perhaps to some of the misunderstandings and disappointments and frustrations of the past.
Yes, thank you. This is my first primates meeting, but I come with the understanding that in any human group, whether it's the Anglican Communion or United Nations or the European Community, there will be challenges and there will be differences. It seems to me, however, that once there is an effort to acknowledge that there are challenges and work out a way of dealing with them, that I think that the life of the community can be enriched and can be continued. There's no doubt that we do have some challenges in the Anglican Communion, but I am heartened by this meeting that there's a real, real effort within the Communion, among the primates here during the course of this week and those who are not here. There's a real effort to deal with the challenges we have and to move the Communion on to a state, to a level, to a place where we can engage in meaningful and creative conversation guided by the Holy Spirit. As you well know, we have been working as a communion through the Anglican Covenant discussion to find that spot in the world, in our communion, where we can all stand and have a conversation. I don't think that we can be unrealistic. I think we must be realistic that there will be differences, and you know as well as I know that these differences in the communion aren't necessarily those that were generated or came into being through the present human sexuality issue. We've always had differences. And over the many, many years of our existence, we have worked out ways and means of dealing with our differences. I have no doubt that with the grace of God and the power of the Holy Spirit, we will continue to work and work very hard to deal with the differences that we know are there within us.
Right. Sorry, Matt, have you got a question? Okay. John?
Perhaps I could ask John Little from RTE News here in Dublin. May I ask perhaps Archbishop Williams and the representative of the African diocese, do you think that the killing of Mr. Kato carries with it or throws into sharp relief lessons which the whole Anglican communion has to learn about the treatment of people of the lesbian and homosexual orientation?
I think that this murder illustrates the fact that words have results. You can't go around sharing information about the identity of supposed lesbian and gay persons and urging people to ostracize them or worse, hang them in the headline of one of the Ugandan newspapers. You can't do that without taking responsibility for consequences. Words have results. And that is certainly a lesson we all need to learn whenever people use any kind of language that dehumanizes or demeans such persons. We have to think these are the possible consequences.
And might I ask whether you as an African churchman feel that perhaps attitudes within the Anglican communion can also have very deadly results. I mean, do you think that those who stayed away, for instance, might reflect on this killing and perhaps on the need for bridges to be built?
I would not make a judgment whether on the people are here or people are not there, because I take this issue not only as a religious issue but as a human issue. And as someone from Africa where death is almost in every corner of the street, I deplore the killing of David as I would deplore the killing of any other human being, because I take human life, the sanctity of the human life. So whether it is from a gay person or someone else, I always denounce and deplore the killing of any person. But when you take the stance on the human sexuality issue or other issues, I won't say that the Anglican Church is really involved, because we have made many declarations of defending and protecting human life wherever it is in danger. So I will not involve whether those who are here or... But the words, as the Archbishop Canterbury has said, have consequences. And we have seen it in many other spheres of life where words and demonization has resulted into death.
Bishop, may I ask a supplementary? What would you say to someone who argued that the exclusion of homosexual persons from ministry of bishop sends out a signal to those who would act violently towards that marginalized group in your own church?
Well, I think you better ask that question to someone else, because in Africa we haven't done any exclusion. I mean, it is an issue. But as far as the ministry is concerned, I haven't had any case in that in Africa.
May I come in briefly on that? The question which has been focused around the exclusion of certain homosexual persons from episcopal ministry is a question about behaviour, not a question about sexual identity. That is, it's a question of whether somebody in a committed and active same-sex partnership is eligible as a bishop, because the church has not traditionally blessed such unions. Now, that's the problem we're involved in. So it's not about the dignity or rights of homosexual persons as such. That's where we stand.
Archbishop, you're saying that it's about their being homosexual.
I'm saying exactly the opposite, that it's not about their being homosexual. It's about the activities and what the church is to make of.
You're saying, therefore, that a homosexual must not be homosexual.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, are you saying that a homosexual or a person of a homosexual orientation must not be a homosexual in the way that a heterosexual person can be a heterosexual person?
No, I'm simply saying that the traditional ethic of the church recognizes that some people have homosexual inclinations, has not blessed homosexual partnerships, and therefore there's unfinished business, to put it mildly, about their eligibility. It's about the exercise of those desires and orientations.
The person on the sexual act. I'm aware of the theology of this matter. Yes. I'm just wondering about the distinction that you make. I mean, you're saying a heterosexual may engage.
That is the distinction that's been made. I don't think that, because it's not something we've been discussing this last few days, I really want to focus on it now.
Well, can I ask you then about the responsibility, indirectly or otherwise, of the climate of Uganda, for what the attitudes that prevail in Uganda today towards homosexual people?
What have you in mind particularly?
Well, the death of David Cato and the
conduct. No, I mean, and the part of the Archbishop.
Well, because of his stance at this particular meeting.
I don't see the connection.
He didn't attend.
He didn't attend because, along with a number of other African primates, he does not want to sit at table with those who have ordained active homosexual persons.
And does that not convey an attitude to...
He was a signatory, along with all the other primates, to the statements we quote in our statement today, deploring and condemning all violence and demeaning language about homosexual persons. He was a signatory to that.
Does that not sound somewhat... Pardon the language of Jesuits.
Should we perhaps move on? Ed?
Sort of going back to the Mass in Hand about communion, you talked about there have always been issues in the past, as you said. The current issue is the ordination of gay bishops in the TEC. That is the current presenting problem. What is going to happen moving forward? Because as far as I can see, they will probably continue with that policy. That's going to further draw the two sides apart. What is going to happen, Archbishop, if they continue to ignore previous communiques and continue this policy, which, as you said, goes against the Church's teaching? It's going to happen.
I have no crystal ball about the future. Clearly, that division is very real. Nobody is denying that. The question is how we cope with it, how we argue with one another, whether we're still able to sit in the same room and argue the case. And that's why I'm sorry that there are those who are not here to continue that argument among us. Meanwhile, what we are able to say together, I've already, I hope, indicated, there is solidarity between churches in the North Atlantic world, churches in Africa, churches in Asia, about a broad range of ethical and spiritual questions, some of which have surfaced in these documents from this meeting. That is not nothing. Some people would say that is more close to the lifeblood of the church than anything else.
Can you see yourself sitting in the same room as the absent primates at the next primates meeting? Do you think they'll come in 2 years?
I've no idea. Let's wait and see, shall we?
Yeah. 5 more minutes. Matt?
At the end of the last primates meeting in 2009, primates called for the development of a pastoral council and the appointment of pastoral visitors to assist in healing and reconciliation throughout the communion. I'm wondering if there's an update on this work. Is it ongoing? Have the primates discussed it this week?
Very briefly, yes. The initial step was to set up a number of pastoral visitors who, on my behalf, participate in meetings in different parts of the world of different regional Anglican groups, different interest groups. They have, for example, attended meetings both of the General Convention of the Episcopal Church in the United States and meetings of the Anglican Church of North America. And they've also made visits in the Global South. They will, on each occasion, listen in to the discussions, report to myself, alert me to any further developments that I might need to be aware of and need to act upon. So there's been action on that. A report was submitted to this meeting, a written report.
David.
May I just go a little off base on the question to you, Archbishop? The ordinariate in England seems to be moving ahead at full steam with about 1,000 parishes, according to the Morning News, leaning over the issue of women's ordination of homosexuality. Is this the beginning of the end the Church of England, and will you be forced to take sides with evangelicals over homosexuality if all the traditionalists leave?
No.
Kevin, have you got a question?
No, I'm still.
Yeah. Anyone else who has not a question?
Is there a concern that the interest being shown by some North American Anglicans in the idea of an ordinary might prompt the Pope to grant that facility to others outside the Church of England?
He already has. The ordinariate proposal is a global one. It's up to each local episcopal conference to implement it as they see fit. I should add that I think some of the estimates of numbers of parishes and faithful transferring to the ordinariate in the United Kingdom are a bit exaggerated.
What would you have to say to those who are transferring? What's your general approach to them?
What I've said to them in person and on paper, if this is for them a step further towards communion with Jesus Christ, God bless them. I can't go with them, I can't agree, but they're doing this in good faith and good conscience, and why should I complain about that?
Bishop, just a quick follow-up on the Cato issue again. I've heard from Uganda saying that the Archbishop will not respond to that until they know for sure that Mr. Cato was killed because he was a homosexual, not a robbery, or his partner who was living with him had fled town, and there may be a little more to this than is thought of, and perhaps you're a little premature in your...
The statement made said, of course, we don't know the full details yet. The fact is, though, that he was someone who had been named in this rather disgraceful Ugandan publication, someone who's, in effect, whose murder had been called for.
Just one very quick final question. How do you feel, Archbishop, and all of you, how do you feel about trying to keep together this diverse community? It's such a hard job. How do you feel personally? You must feel it's so difficult, surely.
You'd like me to do some public hand wringing, would you? Of course, it's difficult. It's the task we've been given. It's part of the gift of living in the church. It's part of the cross we carry. It's part of the hope of the resurrection we work with. I don't know if others would want to add anything.
I think at this moment, at the end of this particular primate's meeting, I feel much more positive about the quality of the meeting, the quality of the engagement, the diversity of the people there, and the commitment to a new pattern of working in the future, not just at the next primate's meeting, which may be 2 years away, but in between. I think there's every reason to feel much more positive at the end of this week than we did at the beginning.
But can you feel, sorry, one very final additional question. How can you feel positive when the other side sort of aren't here to talk about the future problems? How's that going to work? Because they might not like it.
The people who are at a meeting are the people who are at a meeting. They have to relate to one another in that context. We've been aware, sometimes painfully aware, of those not with us. We've prayed for them daily. We are committed to maintaining a relationship with them. But no meeting can allow itself to be shaped wholly by the people who are not there. We've tried to be present to one another and work as honestly as we can with one another. I believe, by the grace of God, that that has happened, that we've been very well served by the quality of the fellowship, and that's something for which I would unreservedly give thanks.
Thank you.